Hello and welcome to the OMPIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we're speaking about modern monetary theory and its impact on public policy. This is Pierre Ortlieb from London, and today we're speaking to Torvald Moe, a former senior advisor at Norgesbank, the Central Bank of Norway, and Professor Robert Hockett, the Edward Cornell Professor of Law at Cornell Law School. Thank you for joining us today and welcome. I wanted to start with a very basic question about what MMT is. And Bob, obviously you're a lawyer or a legal academic. I was wondering if you could clarify for our audience perhaps what the roots of MMT are in this tradition. Why is law and sort of understandings of legality so important to MMT?
A great question, Pierre. So I myself am not a sort of card-carrying member of the MMT community, and yet my views and their views seem to converge almost 100%. And I think that the reason for that is precisely the fact that, in effect, MMT is rooted in the law. So probably the primary antecedent to MMT was the so-called Chartalist school of thought on money. It's typically associated with a great German legal economist or lawyer economist named Friedrich Knopp, who wrote a book a bit over 100 years ago now called The State Theory of Money. And his central idea was that money is a creature of the state. It's a sort of emanation of the state. It's something that's issued by the state. And once one takes account of that fact, various consequences follow, particularly in an economy that is more or less capable of being autarkic and at the same time is more or less fully regulated or overseen by a sovereign with all of the incidents of sovereign power. Now, that's, of course, music to the ears of somebody with a legal background, as I have. My background is in both law and finance. And as a lawyer financier type, I'm always mindful of the legal character of pretty much every instrument that's traded in the financial markets, right? These things are basically tradable contracts. All financial instruments are. All the paper and virtual paper that people trade on the markets are ultimately, at bottom, legally created or legally constituted instruments. They're forms of contract. And the thing that really blows the mind, I think, of people who haven't thought about this very much is that money is no different. The easiest way to see this, if you're in the U.S., for example, is simply to pull a dollar bill out of your pocket and read across the top. It'll tell you it's a Federal Reserve note, and people with legal backgrounds, of course, understand that the word note is a legal term. It's short for promissory note. It's, in other words, a promissory note, a kind of liability or debt obligation that is issued by the issuer. In the United States, that's the Fed, i.e. the central bank. And the currencies of most other jurisdictions are similarly issued by sovereign or quasi-sovereign organs known as central banks or monetary authorities. So given that fact, you know, somebody with a legal and financial background finds the MMT folk basically playing his or her song, because this is effectively what they're focused on as well.
So you touched on a key term, I think, which is sovereign or sovereignty. Can you just elaborate for us very briefly why that's so crucial to MMT? And specifically, I think most people, when they hear the term sovereign, they think of political sovereignty, but there's a very specific understanding of monetary sovereignty that's crucial here, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of think of sovereignty in either of two ways, and I think both ways are correct. I mean, to be comprehensive about sovereignty, it's best to think of it in both of these ways. One is to think of it in formal terms, and the other is to think of it in more sort of substantive or practical terms, right? So in formal terms, when we talk about a sovereign, we're simply talking about that authority, that collective agent or that collective organ that is recognized by the broadest sector of a particular society as having authority to sort of act in the name of the entire population, right? To act in the name of everybody. It's in effect the ultimate collective agent to solve the various collective action problems that collectivities, that groups of people face routinely, right? And the highest level of collective agency is that which acts in the largest number of members of the collective. So legally speaking or formally speaking, that's effectively what sovereignty is, and that's what the state is. Then we just call the sovereign the state or the polity or the government or what have you. Now, the other way to think about sovereignty is in practical terms, right? So you might have somebody who is legally the legitimate authority over a particular group of people or a particular society or a particular territorial jurisdiction, but as a de facto matter, doesn't really have any power, doesn't really have any authority. Nobody obeys it. Nobody listens to it. We typically call places like this failed states, and that phrase itself is quite telling and kind of tells you everything that you need to know. And what that tells us also then is that there can sometimes be practical limitations on sovereigns, even when they are unquestioned, or I should say unquestionably, formally speaking, the sovereigns. Now, when it comes to money money in particular, that can be an especially important point to keep note of, because oftentimes a country, for example, that doesn't have anything even remotely resembling economic autarky, a country that has to import lots just in order to live ordinary lives, of course has to purchase stuff from other countries unless it's going to conquer them or steal from them. And that means in turn that it has to use other countries' currencies and not just its own. And that means its own monetary sovereignty as a practical matter is rather less than is, say, the monetary sovereignty of a nation like the United States or a nation like China or most of the other larger and well-developed polities of the world.
That's right. So this idea of monetary sovereignty, of being the master of your own currency. Torvald, can you talk us through the fiscal implications of this concept? So I'm thinking specifically of this idea that Bob referred to of money being sort of a creature or a product of the state. How should we think about taxation and other elements of the fiscal state within this framework? What's the relationship between these terms?
Well, let me just start by saying here that I'm not an academic, I'm a former central banker, and I just want to add to what Bob said regarding the money process here, that you know the familiar story about money going around as something emanating from barter, and the Robinson Crusoe story is very fixed in the story we tell in central banking about trust and convenience and something emerging as money. And just, it's a very different story from the MMT story. And I also wanted to add that my work has been very much in financial stability, financial regulation. And again, you go through Keynes and you read and you discover Minsky, which was my way of sort of discovering MMT, and you find that there are different stories about money that the one we traditionally teach at the universities or hear in the speeches from central bankers. Anyway, regarding the state and the fiscal, traditional story has been that the state has to keep its house in order, that you need to balance your book, and it's a story about Schwab being housewife, and if you're not careful, you will destroy the wealth of the future generations. With MMT, it's slightly different in the sense as the government can spend its own money. It spends money into existence and then it taxes them back. And so in a sense, it's the ability to set the accounts or define what money is and the ability to enforce taxes that enables the government to command real resources. And this is actually why Keynes in his study about ancient money said that this is the way it's been for the last 4,000 years. And in fact, I think that's why the term is called mother money theory, because it refers to these 4,000 years modern state money.
Why exactly is that story important? What are the implications of it for the way we think about money? Because you rightly distinguish between this kind of barter story that a lot of central banks rely on, although some have been taking steps to explain, sort of counteract this loanable funds theory that has also been dominant. But what are the implications of different historical understandings of money for contemporary economic policy?
I think there are at least two reasons that that's important, Pierre, and they're both sort of mutually complementary and sort of interrelated. The first is this: if we start with the barter story and then assume that money was just something that was sort of added on later as a matter of convenience, a kind of a transaction cost saving device, it actually encourages us to think in terms akin to those of the loanable funds theory that you just talked about. In other words, it becomes tempting to think that money itself doesn't matter, that money doesn't actually make a difference. It's merely a veil that conceals or that operates over the surface of more fundamental transactions that are just bartering transactions. That then, in turn, tends to lend weight or give aid and comfort to people who are of an austerian persuasion when it comes to economic policy. And it also, and here's the related point, it tends to give aid and comfort to those, or at least encourages thinking that you don't really have to regulate the monetary system or the financial system all that much, because money is sort of inherently limited already, and so you don't have to worry about bubbles. They can't even happen. And indeed, as Torvald, I'm sure, would attest, there were many American central bankers, at least prior to 2008, and especially American academics, people like Eugene Fama over at Chicago, who would actually argue that a bubble not only didn't happen, but bubbles are simply impossible. They can't happen. And the thing is, I think in order to believe something like that, you have to believe that money is not endogenously issued. In other words, you have to believe that money is sort of an inherently limited supply, just as the resources that one barters would be an inherently limited supply. And when you think that way, then, again, you sort of impose constraints on yourself that are unnecessary in the name of austerity, and you ignore a financial sector that needs to be regulated with a view to the ever-present possibility of hyperinflations in asset markets, i.e. bubbles. And you miss that, too, if you think of money as simply a veil, as simply a kind of an inconsequential add-on that masks a more fundamental reality known as barter.
I think Robert mentioned is really a theoretical issue regarding the models we use, and this axiom of the wheel, which is pervasive in economic modeling, is really problematic, and Minsky in particular pointed this out in his writing. But let me just mention two things. One is regarding the financial stability issue, and that's really the monetary, or the perception of the monetary system as a hierarchy of money. This is very critical in MMT teaching, and it sort of had the sovereign at the top, and then you have this hierarchy of money where you can have a lot of money in the fringes, but the basic banking system, as we know, is propped up by the power conditions of the central bank, and then you have shadow banking in these other systems, which sort of showed the fragility at the fringes under the crisis. Now, regarding the implications for financial and monetary policy, I wanted to make this point, and it relates to an issue which is also central to MMT, which is sectoral balances. And it's really unfortunate that we've had this sort of perception that the government should balance its books, since on occasion that has led to the private sector contracting and the government contracting at the same time. And there are several economists who know that this is wrong, and Martin Wolf in the Financial Times wrote eloquently about this after the crisis. I think at the end he despaired and gave up because there were so many who didn't want to hear that. But essentially, MMT is saying that when the government spends, it creates assets for the private sector to save, either in money or in bonds, depending on how the mix is. And it's really the government's responsibility to add demand when the private sector contracts. And this is really basic Keynes stuff. It's really amazing that one has to repeat this, but it's a key part of the MMT story as well. And it enables the government to not only spend over the cycle, but in general to spend whatever it wants, as long as there are real resources available.
Very, very important point. That's the thing, is I think Torvald really characteristically put his finger right on one of the central matters that everybody interested in financial stability ought to be attending to. What we might want to do in this connection, when you have a moment, Pierre, is say a little bit about how banks work, because banks are a very important part of the money supply or the money system, and the way operate is part of why money is indeed a thing in its own right, and why indeed money is not limited in supply in any sort of natural sense, but has to be modulated through collective action, typically by a central bank or monetary authority.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that that's crucial. So if you don't mind, I'll actually ask you to just explain the way in which money works in this model.
Sure. Happy to do that. So, you know, kind of corresponding to the myth of barter and the view of money as simply a transaction cost saving add-on to something more fundamental like barter, corresponding to that is a particular view of what banks do and even what financial institutions more generally do and what the financial system does, right? So I would wager that more than 9 out of 10 people you would ask if you were simply to walk out on the street and ask people how banks work, would tell you something kind of like this. They'd say, well, you know, people save up money, they put it in the bank. The bank then lends that money out to other people who have need of it temporarily, right, who have need of temporary use of that money. And so the sort of slogan version of this picture is the slogan whereby we say deposits make loans, right? The banks take in the deposits and then they make the loans out of those deposits. In fact, however, that just isn't correct. And not only is it incorrect, it's sort of 180 degrees incorrect. In other words, it stands the actual truth of things on its head. It would be much more accurate to say that loans make deposits than to say deposits make loans. Now, that at first rings counterintuitive, and it just kind of shows us, I think, the fact that it rings counterintuitive shows us how powerful the grip of the barter myth and the sort of natural scarcity of money myth has on our minds and on our imaginations. But if you simply look at a garden variety banking transaction, bank lending transaction, let's say, you can see right away the sense in which the commonly accepted myth, which I call the intermediated scarce private capital myth, how it gets things exactly backwards. So if you go into a bank, Pierre, and you want to borrow some money, you're going to go in there, you're going to say, I need the money, I need it for this. Here's the project I want to deploy the money to sort of pursue. Here's my credit rating. Here's my background information. Here's my previous borrowing history and payback history and so forth. The bank's loan officer and others are then going to look at your credit score. They're going to look at your credit history. They're going to look at the particular project you have in mind and what they think that the prospects of its succeeding are. And once they actually approve the loan, the two last things that are going to happen are these. A, you are going to sign what is known as a promissory note. And you'll remember I mentioned promissory notes before. And then the bank is going to open an account in your name, or it's going to credit an account that you already have, or it's going to cut you a cashier's check that you will go and deposit in an account someplace else. When it does that, it is actually generating the money that is that account, that is that deposit. And what makes that possible in turn is that you are now able to take a bank card that is associated with that deposit and make payments with it, and people will accept that card in payment. Whereas if I, Robert Hockett, issue your card with a magnetic strip or a chip or whatever, and you try to make a payment with it, it's not going to work. Now, the central bank in most jurisdictions runs the payment system, so it determines which cards, quote unquote, are accepted in payment. And so, in effect, the central bank, acting in coordination with these private institutions, are generating the money supply simply through lending. And that's why many Keynesians and post-Keynesians will sometimes refer not just to money, but to what's called credit money or bank money. And the key point about that, right, is that, again, that can be generated ad libitum, right? It can be overissued, in other words, which is just to say it is possible for there to be too much money sometimes, chasing, as they say, too few goods or too few services or whatever. That's where inflation comes from. We typically think of it in connection with goods and services markets, but in the last 30 years, it's been actually much more common in asset markets and financial markets. That's all that an asset price bubble is a hyperinflation in assets. And what makes it possible is precisely the fact that money is not inherently scarce, as I mentioned before, and that means in turn that its supply has to be carefully modulated by some collective agent acting in the name of us all, and most of the time that is a central bank or monetary authority. So the nature of money and the nature of banking and then the nature of the central bank's task all go together like links in a chain. And as soon as we understand the underlying mechanics of bank operations, we understand how that can all be. We understand how money gets generated, how it can be overgenerated, and why central banks make mistakes when they don't modulate well, and why they're doing just the right thing when they do modulate well.
That's right. And I like that you mentioned inflation, because I think there's quite a lot to unpack in the points that you've both made so far. So I was wondering if I can ask Torvald to maybe synthesize what you just said, Bob, with the kind of sectoral balances approach and with the kind of MMT conception of inflation. And what I mean specifically by that is to home in on this idea of revenue not being a constraint, but rather inflation being the main constraint on deficit spending. So if you can, Torvald, could I ask you to mesh those ideas together if you can?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there has been a misconception, and some of the critique that has been in the media about MMT, I think it's misplaced, that they characterize MMT as spending money and printing money widely without any regards to any constraints. A key point that has been made by many MMTers is that there is primarily a resource constraint, not the financial constraint. So, you know, typically when you ask, how can you pay for this or how can you pay for that, there is mentioning about going to war or financing the new Green Deal. And obviously, the government has the authority and the capability to spend in such circumstances. But typically, there is a resource constraint. So if you are going to go to war, like Keynes was writing the pamphlet, How to Pay for the War, the key point he made was, if you want to use real resources to mobilize for the war effort, you need to constrain some private sector agents so that they don't use up all the resources, otherwise you'll get inflation. And I think this is a point that MMTers are making and are unduly being criticized for. I mean, obviously there is a potential for inflation if you let the printing press run wild, but I would like to add also that currently, too high inflation has not been a problem in most advanced countries. And on the contrary, central banks have had difficulties in meeting their inflation targets. So yes, there is a real resource constraint. There is a problem of potential inflation, but there is no inherent financial constraint on the government. That's a key MMT point.
One thing I would add, Pierre, on the sectoral balances piece of your question is another very important, I think, element that goes into informing MMT, as well as going into informing central bankers and lawyers, is just simple accounting. I think Torvald and I would probably agree that one of the central flaws or sort of unfortunate losses in much of contemporary economics, especially over the last, say, 50 or 60 years, is the loss of real attention paid to accounting and the loss of attention paid the importance and significance of accounting, right? The real central insight of accounting for present purposes is that to every asset there corresponds a liability, and to every liability, their correspondent asset. Now, again, these are legal terms, so of course lawyers find them interesting. But again, accountants and financiers find them interesting too, because these legal categories and these legal instruments that are constructed with these categories in mind are at the core of the financial system, and indeed at the core of the money system or the monetary system. And once we pay attention to those accounting categories, and especially the central one, the simple tautology that to every asset there corresponds a liability and vice versa, we see right away that certain things that people have traditionally feared or sort of thought to be worrisome are only fearsome or worrisome if you misconceive them by ignoring this kind of double entry bookkeeping aspect of accounting, right? So take a government deficit, for example, or just government debt. I live most of the time in New York City, and I live fairly near one of those ridiculous public debt clocks that are kept up on sides of buildings that are counting up the national debt every half second or whatever. And anytime I'm walking by that clock with a friend who doesn't know anything about economics or finance, I'll sort of joke and say, oh, there's the private wealth clock. And they say, what? The private wealth clock? And I was like, yeah, the private wealth clock. I thought it was the public debt clock. I said, well, yeah. And your point is? The basic idea being that the U.S. government's liability in the form of treasury securities are other people's assets. And indeed, they're thought to be the safest of all possible financial assets out there. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no limit at all when it comes to running deficits or racking up debt or what have you. It just means that, as Torvald said, the real limit or the real concern is the resources that sort of underlie the whole thing. And those, by resources, we mean not just natural resources that you dig out of the ground, but also resources in the form of goods and services that human beings can produce together when they're able to borrow temporary claims on resources, i.e. money, and then to produce more, right? And if you keep productive activity sort of in sync with the money supply growth activity, then you don't have to worry about inflation, right? One thing I always like to say to my students, at least, because it's an easy mnemonic, I wish I could make a bumper sticker out of it, but people would probably just scratch their heads, but it's that inflation is a relation, right? Inflation is always a relation. It's a relation between the money supply on the one hand and the stuff that can be purchased or commanded with that money on the other hand. And what you want to do is maintain a kind of parity between these two quanta and see that they grow in a kind of synchronicity or a kind of tandem. That's actually what matters. And it's much easier to see that that's what matters rather than just the sheer number or size of the debt or the sheer size of the money supply. If you keep in mind, again, that debt is not just debt, it's also an asset for somebody else. And you've always got to look at both sides of the balance sheet, so to speak, if you want to understand whether the economy is in balance or out of balance and whether it's operating on a sort of sustainable path or an unsustainable one.
Just wanted to add one point here regarding central balances. It's sort of interesting because this concept has been around for years, and its statisticians work with it under the term of flow of funds analysis. And actually also in the Fed, a lot of work is being done on these statistical balances. Unfortunately, they have not been so prevalent in the economic analysis and certainly in the monetary policy discussions. So they've sort of become a bit of a back burner. And my second point was just I wanted to mention a key person there in the MMT sort of tradition, which is Abba Lerner. Talking about inflation targeting, I think the key difference between the current paradigm and MMT is that they think you should have a different objective or a different focus of policy. And Abba Lerner used to term this functional finance. And his point was you should have primary focus on getting jobs for people, I mean, towards full employment and not focus on some finance. And then obviously you would have to respect the resource constraints. So you would need to balance the policies to avoid inflation. But the focus is distinctly different in terms of the objectives. So you can say that employment takes precedent over inflation.
I want to get to the stances central bank can take in this scenario in a second. I just want to ask one further question about the sectoral balances specifically. If I'm not mistaken, though, Bob, you spoke about private wealth and public debt, but I think if I'm not mistaken in the sectoral balances approach, the external sector plays a fairly significant role as well. And as we all know, a significant amount of U.S. treasuries of U.S. debt are held by external parties, including China, Japan, and other countries. What's the role of the external sector in the sectoral balances? How does it complicate this relationship?
Yeah, it's a very, very important question, Pierre. Thanks for adding that in, because that is a critical piece of the story as well. So the precise significance of the sort of external sector, or the sort of, let's say, non-domestic holders of sovereign or public debt, sort of depends on the particular sovereign on the one hand, and on the size of the debt that's held by the external sector, let's call it, on the other hand, right? So there's an old adage or quip associated with Keynes, again, although I think he got this from bankers with whom he tended to hang around a lot in his day. They say, I think that the old saying was something like, you know, owe your banker £1,000 and you become his slave. Owe your banker £100,000 and he becomes your slave. And what he's basically getting at is there are, at some point, the debt that you owe to another party can become so large that the other party's own solvency or financial well-being or economic health depends on it, so that they're not really able to sort of strong arm you in quite the way they might otherwise have been able to do. Of course, having thousands of nuclear-tipped missiles probably doesn't hurt either. But the main idea is that the particular power that the debtor has plays an important role in determining the significance of the fact that there's a foreign sector that also owns it. Another important factor is, again, the degree to which the economy of the sovereign whose debt is partly held by others is capable of getting by on its own in a pinch, if need be, right? Now, the United States, as you know, imports a great deal and is significantly dependent on its global trade relations, but it's not so dependent on those relations as, say, a country like Japan used to be and still is in many ways, or a country like the UK, or even more so, of course, an economy that still hasn't entered into a development phase yet and hence is almost entirely reliant on, say, a single commodity or a single agricultural crop or two. In a case like that, it's a lot harder for you as the debtor country to sort of try a power play against your creditors, because you're apt to need to be able to access those credit markets again in future, even for your very survival. But again, if you're a country, and this in a sense this takes us back to that sort of practical aspect of sovereignty that we were talking about a few minutes ago, as distinguished from the formal or merely legal aspect of sovereignty. So that can be important. Maybe the final point to make in this connection is that the United States is in something like a unique position. It's a difference of degree more than kind, I think, but it's such a difference of degree that it almost becomes functionally equivalent to a difference of kind. And that is that the dollar is, of course, the de facto global currency. And that in turn is because U.S. sovereign debt, U.S. public debt is regarded globally as the safest of all financial assets out there, at least the safest of all those that are available in great abundance, where you can actually hold trillions of dollars worth of them. And that, of course, gives the U.S. a great deal of leeway and a great deal of cheap credit, as you might put it, when it comes to its international involvement. And that, of course, has been a source of great resentment from other jurisdictions at various times, probably most notably the person of Valéry Giscard d'Estaing back when he was finance minister of France in the 60s, when he referred to the advantage that the U.S. had and the dollar had as the so-called exorbitant privilege. But a key point maybe to close this remark on is to say that in a sense, every sovereign has some degree of exorbitant privilege. What really makes the difference, though, is how much such privilege you have. And that in turn is, I think, a function of the demand for your instruments in the world and hence the demand for your currency in the world.
Can I just ask a follow-up on this? To what extent does the degree of sovereignty influence the ability to run a deficit and to manage this resource / inflation constraint? So I'm thinking specifically of countries like, say, Canada or Australia, who don't have the privilege of the exorbitant privilege, so to speak, but also aren't exactly reserve currencies, and there isn't as much demand on global markets for their public debt. To what extent does this framework apply to them as well?
Sure. Well, it's often remarked that one thing that made it possible for the United States to run very large deficits and a very large national debt was precisely the fact that we were able to import a great deal very cheaply. So in effect, you'd have goods coming into the country that kind of corresponded to the money supply, in effect, preventing that kind of too much money chasing too few goods problem. And furthermore, and relatedly, maybe this is sort of the flip side of the same observation, it tended to keep putting downward pressure on the prices of goods and services, which maybe helped to keep inflation rates down in the goods and services markets. I personally think that's probably a little bit overstated in one particular sense, and that is that had we actually not been relying so heavily on others to purchase our debt instruments, the dollar itself would presumably have become a little bit cheaper, and that would have lessened imports, and that could have generated inflationary pressures at home. But at the same time, flip side of that is it might also have generated a great deal more productive activity here at home by sectors of our economy that had gone more or less moribund after we liberalized our trade relations. And it could very well be then that domestic production would have been much higher in an alternative scenario, which itself also then would have had counterinflationary effects. So it's kind of, as far as I can tell, the data doesn't let us know, doesn't sort of declare definitively one way or the other whether foreign demand for our dollars and hence the ease of importation of lots of cheap goods from elsewhere was the critical factor in preventing inflation. I think we probably would not have had serious inflation even had that not been the case.
Torvald, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Not really, except that people are complaining about shortage of safe assets. And I think the most obvious choice for everybody is U.S. dollars. So, I mean, if you run a balanced budget, you don't create safe assets for the private sector to save. So that's, again, the accounting framework kicks in.
Thank you for that insight, Torvald. We will end today's episode here. Thank you very much to you both. We'll continue this discussion next week on part two of this episode, where we'll home in on the tools used to tackle inflation, the role of central banks, and the job guarantee in MMT, as well as the urgency of a potential Green New Deal.